Hello, listeners. I'm Martin Kessler, and you're listening to FlixWise Canada. Joining me today is Tony Stella, master poster designer, who you might have already seen some of his work, and also a huge film buff. Some people might have already heard you on the Wrong Reel podcast. I think we have a lot of crossover. And you're here today to talk about Kon Ichikawa's Revenge of a Kabuki Actor, which might not be the actual title. So yeah. When we started talking about doing this podcast, it was before the Criterion version was released even. And on that release, it's just called Revenge of an Actor.
Yeah.
So there's a bit of title confusion, which I think I looked into it a little bit, and it seems like neither English title is necessarily a good representation of what the Japanese title is.
Yeah, my Japanese, unfortunately, isn't good enough. I've lived in Japan for a while. But to do just backtrack a little bit, of course, it feels weird because you're in my head so much through Wrong Reel and that kind of mastermind James Hancock that's all kind of connected us in this weird way. It feels like we've had a thousand conversations already. I love you, particularly with the Pink Smoke. You've done some amazing episodes that I keep going back to, the Fassbinder one and the Imamura one, which is a masterpiece. I love that one. And I rarely go back to podcasts, but there's such a rapport between you three that it's fantastic. And of course, with Marcus recently, and every time you're a guest on Wrong Reel, I just love it. So it's bizarre that we only get to do this now. And it's been, like you said, so long in the working, because you asked me basically when I posted my alternative Criterion covers that maybe we should go on before the release, and then it sort of never happened, and I felt really bad because every time I told you I have no time, then I launch into a Wrong Reel episodes with 4 hours long or something. But it just sort of the topic was weird because it wasn't pressing enough, really, and I've known this movie for such a long time and loved it so long that when the Criterion finally came out and people were talking about it, it kind of felt the urge was gone for me to kind of praise it in a weird way, because that often happens. It's kind of you're ahead of your time, and then you fall into this weird situation where it's kind of now you've got to take the other side, right? It's a little bit weird because that happens a lot. Every time a Criterion thing comes out that connects us to this actor's revenge. I love this film. I have it on VHS. I saw it I have it from the 90s. I think 98 was the VHS release, and so I've always seen it cropped. I've never even seen the widescreen, so it's been a weird experiment.
Oh my god! Yeah, I can't even imagine this in the full screen. Exactly. I've seen it. Such a widescreen movie. Like one of the widest screen movies, not necessarily in aspect ratio, even though it's very wide, but just the framing of it is so deliberately made for its aspect ratio. And sometimes they'll frame out, there's going to be something at the top and bottom to just exaggerate the horizontal nature of the frame. It's really, I'm not even sure what that would be like, but I was gonna say, like, it's a little bit, you know, it's sort of what you're saying, like it felt like a secret, this movie, like it's this great film. I found I never saw it on VHS, but I found like the older DVD, I think maybe when a video store was going out of business. I was just browsing and the title jumped right out. The Revenge of a Kabuki Actor. What is this? You know, how does a kabuki actor get revenge?
Such a cool surprise, because the covers were all kind of lame and it was just like a close-up and you're like, I don't know, is this like a Crucified Lovers? Is this like a Last Chrysanthemum kind of Mitsuguchi thing? And then you watch it and you're like, whoa, this is pulp, awesome fights and color and Suzuki style 60s Nikatsu color, and you're like, what's going on? This is, and that's why it felt so cool. And it's not, you never hear Japanese kind of movie critics talk about it, because in the realm of kind of Kon Ichikawa's masterpieces, they don't remark upon it at all. Kind of, it was a job for hire from Daiei Studios, and it kind of marked the 300th film of Katsuo Hasegawa, who was like this kind of 1920s silent film matinee idol and their big star, and they wanted to mark this occasion in some way and had the idea to remake the kind of earlier trilogy about the exact same thing, the same actor. And as you were alluding before, it kind of translates to more as kind of not the revenge of an actor, but it's henge means phantom. So it's like kind of
Yukinoyo,
Yukinoyo, the actor's name, and then phantom. So it's been a trilogy, and it's sort of what I have never managed to see that anywhere. I've tried to track it down.
Have you? I No, I had no luck finding it. I don't think it's lost because I read a few people's descriptions of it, so I think it must exist somewhere. It's not like a lot of 1930s Japanese films are lost. Yeah. But I guess it was from a serialized story and then turned into the version, which also starred Hasegawa. Like he's in both versions, which is like it's sort of like, okay, we're going to take this actor, and in celebrating this 300th film, we're going to kind of recreate
which is one a of cool idea. Roles. I love but that. It's kind of like, okay, now you're so a little bit older, like... and maybe you have the double chin, and you don't look like, you know, one of the most beautiful Dai actors is kind of, you know, Ayako Wako. She falls in love right away, and you're like,
all the women sort of fall for him instantaneously. Like, it kind of makes me think of like rock stars who are more androgynous, you know, that it's like the more feminine they look, the more women kind of go crazy for them. Like, it made me think a lot of that. And I mean, I think a lot of maybe particularly Western critics, I haven't read or dug into the Japanese reception for the film as much, but like the Western critics keep trying to look through the lens of, okay, how does this relate to Kabuki theater and like trying you know, put like the old-fashioned theater, reading that into the film. And like, to me, this is so much more rooted in like 1930s pulp traditions, like you sort of alluded to. I mean, in some ways, this is like, maybe Batman's not the best example, even though, you know, he has his own Alfred character, but it's like the parents are dead and it's going to be, you know, all these sort of scenarios of getting revenge and using his skills as an actor. Like, you know, one of the best parts is when he pretends to be a ghost to sort of drive one of the men responsible for ruining his parents to death, you know, to madness. Like, to me, it's sort of like in the tradition of 1920s, 30s pulp serialized stories. So, like, I think it has more in common with a film like Judex, maybe the remake, which is sort of like boring, also from Le Vampire and that kind of thing. Like, it feels a little bit closer to that, where it's like, hey, this is kind of a throwback, but we're also going to be poppy and make it cutting edge. It's not just a dated thing. It's like, we're going to take this iconography and this sort of storytelling and update it and make it colorful and sort of exciting in that way. So I think, like, to me, that's part of the appeal, is sort
completely.
Of
And that's what jumps out at you. You're not watching this kind of... it's what a lot of directors did, and that's what's so fun. And just when you start to connect this tiny world of Japanese cinema that's, you know, in the golden age, specifically in the 50s and 60s, that everybody interacts. And in under this old studio system, often people cannot cross over, but a lot of people do, and they switch studios. And Konishikawa worked for all the major studios, and he has history with all of them. And he's sort of his genre jumper, and he kind of takes on a lot of different genres, a lot of things that are put forward by the studios that are not like Suzuki did. And Suzuki under Nikatsu had to deal with all the subpar B material, but then found amazing formal ways to completely invigorate these and make these amazing films out of something, art house cinema out of something that never lends itself. And Konishikawa is a master of this. And that's also always remarked by critics, that he's kind of like a jumbled kind of filmography and here and there. But that's positive.
I kind of get that, because it's like, how can anyone go from making Fires on the Plain to this? Yeah. Like, they're so different. Like, Fires on the Plain is so sort of grounded in reality and grit, and, you know, the black and white intimacy, the intensity of it. It's so bleak. And then, like, you know, this, again, we're saying it's very pulpy, although, like, there are sort of melancholic aspects to it. And maybe you can sort of say that there's definitely, like, a formal confidence behind both films, even though, like, stylistically they're so different, narratively they're so different. You know, it, like, to me, the Revenge of a Kabuki Actor, it reads like a film that's absolutely confident. Like, Konichikawa knows exactly what he's doing, and it's such an unusual film, but, like, it never feels accidental, or it never feels sort of... like, it's stumbling, even though it's got jazz music, it's got some very unusual qualities. You know, it's like there's a certainty behind it that I find sort of floors me.
That's why the joy is all in the form. It's not really the story. The story, the revenge kind of scaffold is always fun. It's like in Kung Fu movies. We fill that role. We know what it is. But then how do they get there? How is it realized is much more interesting. And of course, Yojimbo in 1961 comes out and Kurosawa willingly changes the whole landscape. He's like, I'm doing a Jidaigeki period piece, but I have jazz music and I have all these different ideas that I managed to somehow pour it into a hole. And same with this, even more crazy. He uses like stylistic elements from silent cinema, and he has so much fun playing with this whole palette all of a sudden, and picture in picture. And it's just, right away in the first 3 minutes, we know everything. We know the revenge. We know it has an inner dialogue that tells us where we are. It opens wide onto the stage, so you right away invested in all of it. And I love when films can do that. It's very Suzuki, it's very Nikatsu, it's very gangster movie of the time, where you're like, okay, I'm into this. And then sort of it slows down a lot later, and sort of sadly a lot of the stories don't pan out because they're not really clever. And I suspect that in the original trilogy, the kind of side plot of all the thieves, the Age of Thieves, is a lot more fleshed out. And that's kind of my favorite scenes, is when we see all the Dai stars make these cool cameos, and then they're just there. He just gives us
I get so excited when Zatoichi shows up near the end.
Yes.
And it's not exactly like a cameo, you know. It's like the Zatoichi movies are taking off, let's put Gatsu in it, like, you know, hey, we're Dae, we got him under contract, like, here, go in this film to make it, you know, we can put you on the poster, maybe. Like, it felt a little bit like that. It's just a small role, but it's like, it's exciting, you know?
Yeah, I mean, they all pay homage, kind of, in a way. It's kind of the send-off. For Hasegawa, Dae was Raizo Ishikawa, I couldn't get bigger star in Japanese cinema. He's really the biggest, and he's coming over to take over. They really want to make this transition from him, and there's a great little... what he does throughout the movie, this little comments that only they would know, when they have the little Robin Hood scene and he's sort of the lesser thief, and he's like, I'll never be as famous as him. And these are all subtext for taking over from him. And these are also the best, most joyful scenes, because you basically have, and Raizo was a real Onagata. He was, from the age of 15, he started in the Kabuki theater, and he played that. And he also was orphan, lived with his sister, very much like Ishikawa, like in the movie. So there's all these cool little chessboard parallels that you can unfold and see. And then it's mirrored in the movie, the way it looks, this widescreen, as you said, and especially behind the scenes of the theater, it becomes this kind of hall of a ship that I always used to love as a kid, when it's dissected in half and you see, and every corner is filled with action, and you're like, oh, where's this, and where do they store this? So he's so aware. And then it cuts completely into black, and you see tiny actors on the top right appear in this vast void. I mean, it's very reminiscent of the traditional Japanese scrolls, and this kind of formal thing that he's playing with. And at one point, when she reads the letter, and it kind of scrolls along, it's very clear how he's using all of this. And yeah, like you said, this is the joy. He's playing with all these things he's learned on earlier movies, on especially, like you said, on Fires on the Plain, which is just a masterpiece.
Absolutely. Well, and what you're saying about the interactions between the actors, like, there is sort of this layering of actors performing as actors performing, and then you sort of get this like stack of layers where, you know, you're kind of conscious of the fact that you're watching performers, you're conscious of the fact that you're watching actors, and it's just sort of fun to see them flexing basically their abilities and sort of all these great things that they can do. Like I mean, one performance I like a lot is Ayako Wakao, who she's like the daughter of one of the people that he's trying to get revenge on, and she falls in love with our lead, Yuki, who they keep calling him Yuki. It's usually a woman's name, right?
Yeah, exactly. And she's sort of like a cozy like nickname, like a cute. In Japan, it always gets abbreviated, like and you, they leave out half of the rest, and it becomes a sort of cute. Yeah, she's of course best known. She was all in Mitsuguchi. She was in Streets of Shame.
Oh, she's in Street Floating of Shame.
Weed. Yeah. She's Red Angel, specifically. That's like her tour de force masterpiece, where she plays this nurse, a field nurse, and it's just
she's really good. I saw her in a film last year. older film at the TIFF Lightbox by Masumura called A Wife Confesses.
Oh, yes.
It's like her husband dies mountain climbing, and that was really cool. She's great in that, you know.
She sort of bridges the gap from the real old golden age directors into the new wild cinema that explodes. And Ichikawa has that thing. He's the bridge in many ways. He has one of the biggest longevities in...
Going from the classic cinema to the new wave. He kind of... He had such a long and varied career, like somebody who started in the 30s.
Yeah.
He made films... pretty close until he died, like in the 2000s. So like, it's a very long career, and you kind of feel like, you know, when this film comes out, it's such a turning point for Japanese cinema. Like it's, you know, like on one hand, there's those 1950s films that like it's not so far away from the you know, samurai films or the period films, the Jidaigeki. And then like, you know, it just feels so hypercharged here. Like again, like a lot of the actors, I mean, a bunch of these actors were all in Mizoguchi films. Before you mentioned Crucified Lovers, like Hasegawa was in that. Like these, you know, that's probably the thing I know him best from. Or he's in
Gate of Hell, which is also...
Gate of Hell.
Yeah,
that was directed by
Kinugasa also,
who did the original. Exactly. Yeah. So like, it's just this sort of, you know, you think. I guess the silent era lasts a little bit longer in Japan. Like, you have 1930s films that came after sound sort of caught on in the rest of the world that were still silent. So, like, it feels like such a big shift from, you know, the silent to the kind of golden age classic to the new wave. But, you know, you're looking at a 30-year period. It's actually not that long a time. So you have a lot of the stars kind of carrying over, which is sort of unusual. So it just sort of stands out as being kind of in this interesting place in the history of Japanese film. Oh, sorry, I went on a... I forgot what I was going to say at first, but like, Wakao, when she after she kills the older guy, the Hiroyima character, like, her hand's shaking with the knife, and she has to like peel her fingers one by one off the knife just to let go. Like, I was thinking, like, wow, you know, it's like... acting. It's so good, but like, it's also very performative, and it's meant to sort of impress you. It's not like a, you know, internal psychological kind of, you know, realist acting. It's theater acting, basically. Like, it's something you could see on the stage, and it's
It mimics kind of Hasegawa in the beginning. The beginning is, it's all in those first kind of 4 minutes, because you see the artificial snow falling on the stage, which turns, then we turn into the stage with a camera movement, and we're inside the scene, and all of a sudden there's no audience, and the snow is thick, and even though it's still in the studio and artificial, we are already in a real world. So he's remembering his own history, and then sort of this kind of great burnout appears, where somebody from the past can enter. It's like a time vortex. Somebody can come in and they remember and they see things. They're telling us subtext that we see, but then it switches back to being real actors on the stage, and we're all of a sudden sucked out of it again, and we're in the theater again. And this happens so quick and so fluidly and so masterfully that we're right there, and we're feeling all these things subconsciously, this artificiality. And it's only upon the like third or fourth viewing that you find out all these kind of boxed in little cool little things that he does. And it's so clever, like you say, the performance mimics exactly when she stumbles in the end with the knife and lets go. It's the exact stumbling that we see on stage before, and we see these kind of Japanese archetypes played out, like the great woodcuts, as well as Nikatsu 60s lighting, kind of color coding, the yellow scenes, the red, it's all signified in that way. And it's just, yeah, it's just endless. I think, and what I think I tend to love this, and a lot of people criticize this about film. It's kind of what is easy to see, because it was a work for hire, kind of pushed on him by the studio, and he finds experimental cool. It was almost like, okay, let me try this. He uses it as a playing field to try things out, rather than kind of tell you the full story. It feels very chopped, the story. It feels very kind of like, especially after the half comes through, the revenge, they're just cool formal pieces, but they're not really tied up the story. This whole kind of sub side piece of all the thieves, which you want to see.
It makes a lot of sense that it was serialized when it first came out, because you can sort of picture, like, okay, like, here's the first, like, it's basically three people he's getting revenge on. It's like, here's the first one, here's the second one, here's, like, you can see it.
Yeah, and you want to see it like
broken
a count
up
of,
and filled with subplots. Yeah,
you want to see it like a Count of Monte Cristo, where he's like, how does he get each one to fall? But they're kind of all tied together, and they all go mad and tear each other down. But it's sort of not, he wobbles one little chess piece and then it all falls. And it would have been cool to see him kind of go in and then using his women, his ways of being a man inside a woman and all that kind of duality to kind of trick them in a clever ways, which never happens. And also the sword fights interludes are so funny because they come from... They're so hyper stylized, and he shows you, oh, I could do this shinobi film. I could do this incredible Chambara movie.
Oh, when the knife comes out of the fan, yeah.
Yeah, it's so awesome. And then he kind of, by the third interlude, it's like a Pink Panther movie. It's like, there he is again. They kind of comment on it, like, are you trying to kill me again? Like, oh, stop it, Kato. It's almost like it's Peter Sellers.
You again, yeah. Yeah, when the knife goes into the tree trunk.
Exactly.
It's funny.
It stands out so much that he's like, and Khan makes this, he's so good. And it's really tragic scenes, melodrama, and then mixed with super comedy. And like you said, this super cool modern jazz score, which is one of the premier jazz pianists who composes many, many soundtracks. He does the Abashiri prison films, the Yakuza Law. His name is Yagi Masao, and he's in the Thelonious Monk biography as being one of his biggest champions around the world. Oh. He kind of spreads monk's music around the world. And yeah, that adds so much to music. It's just so fantastically...
It gives it this flavor that you wouldn't expect. Like, yeah. It immediately sort of says, like, hey, this isn't old-fashioned, this is cutting edge. Or, like, a lot of the scenes, they have this sort of contemporary overtones, even if you're watching something set in the period. Like, there's the scene where Ohatsu, the kind of bad girl of the film, the other leading lady, Fujiko Yamamoto, when she's kind of, like, sitting over the... Or, like, leaning over the prints, the woodblock prints, I guess that are meant to be of Yuki. She's kind of, like, fawning over them. The way somebody would be fawning over, like, a magazine cover. And, like, to me, it looks like...
Yeah, kind of 60s spoiled housewife going through Bazaar magazine. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they keep mentioning sort of, like, oh, you're the most famous man in Tokyo. I'm... We're the two most famous men, the actor and the kind of... Shogunate loyal rice merchant. And that's sort of, yeah, you keep forgetting this is really high society, and the music transports that. And yeah, it's just like you said, to just in the framework of Ichikawa movies, like you said, I mean, he was kind of looked at as a kind of not a serious director. He does very many satirical comedies about the time with his screenwriting partner and later wife, Nato Wada. They marry in 1948, and that's been sort of the golden age of his filmmaking, all scripted by her, and is in this great collaboration where they turn many of the great literary books, famous books of the time, into great movies, and very consciously are not kind of, you know, making these just flattering pieces, but making it into movies. And she's very much at the helm of this. And after she quits, after the Tokyo Olympiad, she retires from screenwriting, and she's very frustrated with the reception, obviously, her husband got after that. She quits, and that's a noticeable cut. And so that's just shortly before. So she's still on The Actor's Revenge, but it's sort of the last two or three films that she does. And it's amazing because they do these art house staples, the Burmese harp, which is under Nikatsu, which he switches studios again because they own the rights, but he falls out with them right away because it's cut, presented in two parts, which he hates and, of course, is stupid because the second half, again, of Burmese harp is so slow and cumbersome, it doesn't work in two parts.
Right. Well, and then he was sort of frustrated with that, and I think he eventually did the remake in the 80s himself.
Yeah, which is awful.
Which turned out awful, but it almost felt like, oh, I'm going to go back and I'm going to fix it. But
yeah,
like,
he
that
does
almost
it many
never
times.
Works out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He does. Yeah. He even remakes the Inugami, which is his biggest hit in the 70s, which is his second, his third wave of films almost, where he lands this amazing hit again, turning this famous detective who has like 77 cases and only one that's translated. It is the Inugami family, and he makes that into a cool film, and then makes five sequels to that, and he remakes that at the very end. I think that's his last film.
Yeah.
And so he has these complete like revivals all the time, and the reason why he stays kind of open as opposed to Kurosawa and Kobayashi and Kinoshita, who he has this Club of Four Nights that fails with unfortunately with Dodeskaden.
Right, the Dodeskaden,
they consciously want to turn Japanese cinema around again, because they come from this golden age and they see it all go to hell with these young wild movies and stuff. And he is the only one that survives, not only in life survives all of them, but he also survives them in kind of making films, because he manages to stay open and he directs commercials, he directs TV early on, and that comes, I think, from his multidisciplinary thing that you alluded to. He comes from animation. He wanted to be an artist. He's a draftsman. So he comes from this tradition, and that's very much more interdisciplinary than all these other directors who are just brought up in as assistant directors in the strict studio system.
There's a flexibility to him, which like, I know for like film criticism can be actually kind of a turnoff for people, because it's like, oh, you know, you want to fit them into this auteurist. This is their style. This is what they do. This is their themes. And like, I think he was just more flexible than that. And like, I think he wasn't always a big moneymaker. Like, I think specifically the reason why he was assigned to Revenge of a Kabuki Actor is his previous, you know, maybe two films or three films were not big financial successes, so they kind of stuck him onto the I mean, that's really interesting that you mentioned that he started in animation, because like this Revenge of a Kabuki Actor, I can picture being remade as a as an animated film, as an anime series, maybe, like, you know, a lot of the you know, not just the storytelling and the acting, but like there's just this graphic quality that you could picture being translated to animation very easily. And you know, like some of the subplots I could see being in an anime.
I mean, the entire way he choreographs the fight scenes is very much like a manga panel. The close-ups,
those black box fight scenes that like that 100% you could picture that being illustrated and put in a manga, and like it would work. You know, you could go, you know, pretty much frame by frame, and it would still work. Like, it just has that kind of visual storytelling and that kind of striking. Like, I think there's one part where somebody's walking by a wall, and it's this like long, you know, it's like darkness at the top and bottom, and it just looks like it, you know, could be a drawing. It could be illustrated, the whole film. I think it's interesting to see maybe somebody take that background in animation and graphic design and kind of applying it to something.
It would be cool, action. Although I would love to see it without all these horrible new filters that they use, and it's so computery. It really would have to be handmade again in the kind of golden age style.
Oh, of course. I mean,
I
it would
hate
be like
this new manga. That's awful. It's when we arrive, you know, this high point in the 80s, and then it all falls apart, and it's because the labor that's put into it really was reminiscent of that Japanese tradition, and having really these studios animated. But yeah, I would love to see that. But sort of, this is something I cannot even read comic books anymore, because I hate the paper so much.
They use, like, even if it's like hand drawn over top of like a digital model, you can still tell. Like, I don't know if you've seen Berserk at all.
Yeah. I love that. I've read the manga, but
it's like the recent ones, like the recent manga. It's like they'll like he's using like a digital outline, and it still looks good, but it's like, it's different. You can tell it's not the same as just like pure hand-drawn.
Yeah, I have such a problem
designs,
with that,
yeah.
Obviously, from my background. I mean, I still hold on to pen and paper so much, and I hate those posters that I can see, and I feel nobody else sees it, and I'm like, it pains me to see that there's all
well,
this.
Well, I mean, that's one thing I really
Photoshop.
Love about your artwork. It goes to this sort of throwback to like the handcrafted quality and the sort of organic look of how movie posters used to look, and it grabs your attention and immediately stands out from stuff that's like using Photoshop clearly, or like
I'm glad it stands out to you, because to many people it doesn't. I get this even, I'm like, and they're like, oh, your stuff is cool, and you get like, oh, you must have picked it because you appreciate this quality, and like, how about this, and you're like, no, of course this is how could you I'm so offended, like this is terrible. But I find I admire this in people when I find it, when I come across it, like this openness that you have. Also Ishikawa has that doesn't matter, and I'm very much stuck. I was never able to progress in these ways because I held on to these techniques. But in a way, he has so much joy playing with these techniques here, Ishikawa, because it's so reminiscent of the Kinoshita, the Ballad of Narayama, the 1958 one,
right?
It's all like painted backdrops, and you're inside the studio, but the artifice is there and meant to be seen, and it's not a cost cutting structure. Or of course in Kaidan, Kobayashi, two of his buddies there, and it's very clear that he makes these links to this conscious studio picture, and he's he's almost like, even though he was very much more prone to using all kinds of techniques, that he's making kind of a love poem and showing you his virtuosity in all of this. And I love this, yes, in Japanese cinema, when you see these great modern directors then take on a period piece and they're like, what's your take on it? It's sort of, it's cool to see how he solves all these forms. And yeah, my favorite, one of my favorite is the yellow school set piece, you know, when he learns.
Oh, when they steal the scroll that's a blank paper.
I wish so that would be like an hour long. I could see much
that,
more.
I know, that could be like a whole episode of something. Yeah. Absolutely. Like, it's just such a weird,
weird
little sequence, but it's so good and clever and funny and stands out, yeah.
And it plays with all these things that we know right away. It signifies all these martial art things and the kind of the secret scroll and the room and the students, and it's like Kenshiro, you have the evil student and the
good
student.
He just grabs the what he thinks is the secret scroll and he runs off.
Like, exactly.
It's such a weird, I'm going to steal the secret knowledge and just run out the door and hope nobody catches me.
Yeah, and how do you interpret that? What does it say? You know, it's like, to use your sword like this. I mean, that would always be, the instructions would be really hard to implement. I mean, okay. But it's, of course, it's empty and that's so cool. But the yellowness of that room is so Suzuki. And, mm-hmm. I mean, he does Youth of the Beast is the same year, but Tokyo Drifter comes even in 66. So that's 3 years later. So he's very much like also using these color coding signifiers from these extreme wide angle shots to then close-ups of the red and just the fan. It's just extreme close-up. And all this fun is felt out through the movie. It just breezes by because it's... Eiji Funakoshi is the other student that kind of keeps attacking him because of
this.
And he's very much the Kon Nishikawa actor of the early period. He's on Fire in the Plains, the kind of the mangled soldier that kind of just schleps himself through the
skinny
whole...
guy, yeah.
Yeah, through the whole movie. And then he's in 10 Dark Women, which is one of my favorite movies. This 1961.
Oh, I haven't seen that one.
Oh, you have to see it. It's like his kind of satirical. It's him and also Fujiko Yamamoto again. And it's kind of this cad, that idiot guy that he plays really, really well. And he's kind of a buffoon. And he gets caught two-timing them. And all these women in his life take revenge on him in the greatest way. Much more clever than in this one. And that's the film before. And Being Two Isn't Easy. Have you seen that one? That's a great Kon Nishikawa film where
there's a whole bunch I haven't seen. It's like, I mean, Konnichikawa, not every film of his I've seen I've liked, even like the Makioka Sisters is like one that's like, I remember watching it and sort of being like, okay, this doesn't really, and it might just be me, like I might come back and like it on another viewing, but I was just thinking like the glossiness of it, the soundtrack, I was like ugh. but like I sort of appreciated how specific that was.
Being Two Isn't Easy from 1962 is the one everybody has to see and seek out.
Okay.
That's Look Who's Talking. It's the baby coming out of the womb narrating what he sees. It's so cool. And nobody knows this connection. And everybody thinks of John Travolta and Kirstie Alley. And it's an amazing movie and comments on all these Japanese kind of... A new young family within traditions caught between the worlds, but it's narrated from the baby's point of view and constantly gives you this dialogue. It's so cool.
That sounds funny.
It's amazing. That's like the one film before this. It's so crazy that he has all these jumps, and you almost see, it's almost, I hate relating myself constantly to it, like as if I was on that level, but it's something that I enjoy, like which each style you find, a different film obviously has to adapt a different poster and a different style of making them. I hate when everybody sort of copies, it's Drew Struzan for every genre, you know, you're like, that makes no sense. This is a comedy, so it's lose a different style. And he does that so well. It's almost like he gets his different toolbox out and he's like, okay, this is a war movie, let me do this. And it's like we said, we can't heap enough praise onto Nato Wada, his wife, and it's felt completely after she leaves and she dies sadly in 1983 of breast cancer.
I mean, like the last couple films, it is like there are films of his that I'm still not sure how to feel about, like, his 47 Ronin in the 90s. I remember watching when they played it on the Independent Film Channel and stuff like that. Like, I'm going to have to go back and revisit at some point. But, it's such a just sort of sprawling film career with, like, gaps I have in certain areas. And then, like, you know, these strong sort of stylistic shifts where you kind of... it makes him a filmmaker that can be a little bit hard to get a handle on, even if I like individual films.
It's unfair because it's, of course, like with all Japanese cinema, whatever we talk about is like the tip of the iceberg because so little is translated. When I lived in Japan, I was just renting. I went to the video store every night and I'm just watching films without subtitles. I have no idea what's going on, but I need to see these. These are films I've read about all my life and I've seen. And all of a sudden, they're just available, but of course, no translation. And just, I just went mad because so much is lost. And so much is lost even if they're translated. But yeah, with Konnichikawa, it's like 83 or 86 films, and we get maybe, we get 20 if we're lucky.
I've seen so few, really, when you add them all up. Like, it's just a tiny fraction. Like you said, it's the tip of the iceberg. Yeah,
I wish there was just a huge con box in Japan, of course, released maybe 2-3 years ago, which collected like the major kind of his mid-period, which I wish I could get a hold of that, but then it makes no sense. It's just so hard. And so much fun is in that dialogue. So much remarks are made, like even at the end where she remarks on his profile, like, you know,
you kind of look like him.
Yukinoyo is gone, exactly. So I'm going for his counterpart, of course, with Yamitaro, which is played by the same actor, of course. And then she kind of remarks, oh, you kind of look like him, I'll take you. And that's so all these moments happen.
I think she says, like, I should have gotten you from the beginning. Like, never mind that guy. And they kind of hook up, sort of, and he's sort of like, you don't want to go with me. I'm gonna turn straight. I'm going to turn my life around. And she's like, yeah, I'm going to follow you.
Yeah, the second half is less satisfactory, but it has enough to keep you going. Stylistically, there's always some innovation that you look at and you're like, you won't notice it the first time, but of course, when you rewatch these things, you're like kind of like, I wish you start to dream what could happen. And it feels very much like it just like giving us, like you said, that serial idea is probably, I'm dying to see the other version to compare. What I've seen photographs of it. Exactly. And the kind of opening credit scene where it's really cool because it has all the exposition and kind of the dialogue of the audience. It gives you the time and the setting, the tempo period this plays in. This 1830, 1844 with the Great Famine. All this stuff is set up very casually and cool within kind of the audience. And it has these flags set up outside the theater, and then the widescreen is completely blacked out. It just gives you these shafts and alleys of light as you see faces appear between the kind of negative shape of the audience. It's so awesome. I couldn't believe it. And then you see the original, it's like, oh wow, this is a quote. It's not even him, like, it's him obviously using the widescreen in a very clever way, but it's also a direct translation of the original film.
Even some of the costumes look identical to me. Like it seems like it was pretty close in terms of what it took from the original. Again, like it's tough to tell without seeing it, but like there's so many things that I really do think could have used elaboration. Like it's sort of a consequence of cramming everything down into a 2-hour film, but like the rice famine when you have the uprising, and that, like, to me, that the uprising was maybe the only part of the film that felt like it took place in real life, you know, when you see the close-ups on the people's faces who were starving, and all of a sudden it doesn't feel like this theatrical stylized thing. It feels real, and that's such a big plot point for what happens with one of the people that he's getting revenge on. But it happens so quickly, really, that it's like, I could see this being a much bigger episode.
You kind of need to know a little bit about the of course, not for a Japanese audience, for them it's like signifies all these things right away, but for the Western audience, you have to know that these rice merchants were hoarding the rice, and there's this great temple famine that goes on for 4 years, and all the rice is hoarded, and the shogunate failed to really, they gave them 4 years, which is a long period, and they kind of starve everybody, and at the end of it, it causes these riots to break out against the big merchants of Edo and Osaka, and so this is the backdrop of it all. Meanwhile, the revenge is of the actor whose father is first kind of pushed out of business by these three men, these three rivals, and then he kind of loses, he goes bankrupt, he grows up in these slums, and he kind of hangs himself, and the son finds him in a very cool scene that's Sergio Leone, the son crying at the foot of his father swinging from the rafters. It's like spaghetti western right away, like, and that's how it also shifts this whole movie. What we've been talking is all very jolly and fun, but then it has this really kind of earth-shattering these moments where you see it's just heartbreaking. And the revenge, the first revenge when he impersonates the ghost of his dead father. Or is it mother or father?
I think it's his father. Yeah. That's an amazing scene. And there's that scene where Yamitaro's on the rooftop. Actually, I think he's on the rooftop often. But, like, you know, when he's just sort of observing Yuki and says, like, I don't think he's enjoying this. You know, he's such a desolate figure as he walks away. And the sort of, you know, maybe lack of fulfillment of the revenge. And, you know, they have that scene near the end where Yuki's speaking with the head of the acting troupe, who's kind of taken him under his wing and helped him along his path. And you sort of get the sense, like, you know, was this really the right thing to do, to like dedicate years and years of your life to this? And, you know, now what? Like, it's actually sort of not this like jolly fun anymore. It kind of gets serious, actually.
Yeah, you don't have a sense really. Oh, when I watch movies, it's very kind of haphazard at first. It just kind of washes over me. I never realized that it took so long. And that, of course, is the interlude you refer to. It has the dates on screen, so you kind of know, oh, it's like 4 years passed between this. But to me, it always felt like it took him so long to get into these guys.
If you just watch it all the way through, it kind of feels like it takes place over like a week or something.
Exactly.
Like, not like years, but...
Like you said, the gravity of it, that is also just a comment, and he uses the thief Yamitaro character, like you said, like the serial, he's kind of the narrator in a way. He's the inner dialogue, then it's narrated by the actor, and then towards the very end by this famous Banshee narrator.
It's like omniscient narrator comes in. Yeah.
So we are led along, because otherwise you couldn't grasp all these things. And it's just a tiny bit disappointing that he takes the young daughter away, which then kills the father's chances with the shogun, which, you know, in feudal Japan ruins, of course, all his life, because he has no more inn, his whole business is destroyed, and he kind of can't produce his concubine anymore. But the other revenge of him using his acting skills and makeup skills to appear as his father's ghost are like the most gloriously shot.
The eye lighting, so dramatic, and it's like, it feels like it could be something out of like Kwadan, like it kind of has that feel to it for that scene. And
beautiful Eastman, like warm colors, is very warm.
Yeah,
and the kind of.
And did you find like did you watch the new Criterion transfer?
I did. I think I got a hold of the latest one that we've kind of been discussing.
Did you find that the colors sort of more muted than it used to be?
Yes, much more muted. I mean. And in my VHS,
I remember
kind of
it being this like poppy
heads.
Kind of color. Yeah,
but that's more because the tape is shit. But this is very much. I mean, it's probably much closer to it than like Gates of Hell is like an explosion.
Gates of Hell, like it's like really showing off. Like, hey, you're watching a color
turn
movie.
Everything up, all the knobs up. Yeah.
Yeah.
No,
there's actually scenes here where it's like gray rooftop, gray outfit, gray background. It's actually like, I sort of don't remember it looking that way. I kind of remembered focusing on the color, but I was actually kind of surprised watching it this time,
it's
just how restrained a lot of it is, actually.
Yeah, and it's very beautiful, especially like you said, in those the umbers and the very dark grayish shadows, those beautiful ones, and then the eyes so yellow, and the way it comes across with the side light, very theater. I mean, the theater lighting here can't be that it's used, the kind of focus of the light is used like in theater to pinpoint attention to several parts, and you know, when he sees his revenge actually being fulfilled, or when they start to crawl amongst each other, then the whole screen is blacked out and you just see his face, and we know it's an aside. Everybody stops like in theater, so we know the scene doesn't continue, and we hear sort of see a close-up or an inner dialogue that continues. That's all these elements are just your heart soars when you watch this as a film nerd, because it's just done with such class and it's never jarring.
Yeah, there's restraint, actually. Like, early 60s, when most films were still in black and white, like I was surprised that it was that restrained, actually, and like a lot of it's focused on, you know, not just the color, but like visually, like actually not going overboard. Like it's actually, you know, as sort of flamboyant as the film can be, it's not garish, you know.
No, it's not Suzuki, which is color. Okay, everything is yellow, everything is, he is setting these up, the purples against the the kind of browns and a kind of tiny silver on his kimono.
Well, it's like I noticed like Ohatsu, she's usually in green, and she's in some variation of this like pale green color for a lot of it, or like
takes the gun out and she has her hair open and,
when she puts the hand over her eye, I love that so much.
And she closes her eye and she holds it. That's so manga, that's a Ninja Scroll, you know, that's an amazing, and then just the kind of blue horizon, all these very Suzuki signifiers that everybody knows. Khan uses it, like, because his next movie is not at all that. Alone Across the Pacific is completely like just washed out colors adventure movie, and so he kind of says, okay, this is my take on it. And of course he blows it out the park. And the cinematography is the same as in Fires on the Plain. So when,
which again is shocking to me. Yeah.
It's shocking, but also what I find, what they, I mean, Khan himself remarks that he's like, I was so much brought up in the other format that it was hard for me to fill the entire screen. But I think if you watch Fires on the Plain, like, there's scenes where it's just the middle of the screen would be like a clearing, and the soldier walks and you see him just stand there kind of Rashomon like, and the rest is just
it
pitch
also
black.
Has that very particular compositions where, like, you know, your eyes will be drawn to one little part of the frame, like you know, you have a big frame and you'll fixate on one little aspect of it. Like, it's it's sort of too bad I never got a chance to see this, like, in a movie theater. Like, if I ever do a retrospective, like, that's one thing that would get me out the door to go and see it for sure.
Anyhow, just a Kon Ichikawa retrospective would be so amazing to see all these genre jumping from next film to next, to see them behind each other. And Katsu,
like,
Miyagawa...
Not, like, the framing's not that friendly for, like, a small TV, you know?
It's completely... Mine was so, like, narrow, I couldn't see anything. It's, like, squinting.
You know, like, on top of the narrow frame to begin with, you'll have, like, everyone just, like, on the left, and they'll be tiny. Like,
exactly.
You know, and it's sort of that feeling of, like, seeing people on the stage, you know, when you go and see a play and, like, they're kind of at a distance and you have to sort of concentrate as they move across the stage.
Very much I find that now watching it again, he does these things deliberately. When we are off the stage, or when it takes another storyline in the beginning of these kind of cuts, we, every time it's the inner dialogue, we get the close-ups every time, and then we get to see, he can place us. That's such like you said, that's such a wise, crafty, skilled, old wise filmmaker already, because he puts us where he wants us, and he puts us inside, outside. We get to see as much as he wants us to see, and you constantly feel like this in great hands. You're never like, oh, I wonder where this movie is going. You just let it wash over you. That's why it also doesn't really matter with the plot so much. It's just you enjoying the formalism of Japanese, why all these movies are so special, and why I reacted to them as a kid right away, even though I didn't understand them. I didn't kind of I gravitated to those. And Conflagration in 1958, of course, is the high point. Also the one which is already with Raizo Ishikawa, which is called The Sin in 1962. Those are probably the most beautiful of the period. It's his collaboration with Katsu Miyagawa, of course, from Rashomon fame, and it's just they're black and white, and you just will never find a more beautiful film. It's just stunning. And again, the story kind of sort of plots along. It's about these kind of, in Japan, these kind of different tribes that are not accepted. Like in Hokkaido, they're called monkey people by the kind of mainland Japanese, and sort of...
Like, I remember hearing about the Ainu people in the north, or those sorts of cultures, right?
The tribal, like, which kind of, in Princess Mononoke, they're trying to give some dignity to those tribes that exist in kind of rural Japan. And that's kind of his, Raizo Ishikawa plays this young teacher who has to fess up and become proud through his writings. And so kind of the story, I couldn't have cared less as a kid, but watching it, there's a fight with a wild bull that the farmer encounters in the beginning. And it starts off with the perspective of the horns, and you're in this widescreen, and it's Miyagawa and the light of the shafts of the rushing clouds against the backdrop of these inky mountains. You're like, what is this? I mean, you're like, you're baffled.
Sometimes, like, those images, they just come out and grab you right away. I mean, again, going back to Revenge of a Kabuki Actor, it's like within 2 minutes, like, I'm completely hooked because it's so graphically captivating, you know, like you're kind of on board just by the strength of the images for a lot of it, and it doesn't
toy around with kind of fake secrecy. They give you everything right away. These are the three men that killed my father. I'm gonna take revenge. It's in the first.
It's such
three
a
men.
Straightforward opening for like such a convoluted plot. Actually, like the story is very bare bones simple. The plot is like needlessly complicated. That's kind of the. I mean, again, that kind of gets into like the fun of like the actors performing. It's like the film itself has to be sort of convoluted to kind of match that, I guess,
exactly,
in a way.
Because and even his kabuki teacher in the beginning remarks that he's like, "Why you gained entrance with right away? Why don't you go see him? I mean, that's your duty. You want to be you're on this revenge. He's his confidant. You it's your duty to see them." And he's like, no, let me play some more with them, and kind of it's not the right time. Something inside told me it's not the right time. You're like, what? Right. Why? I mean, later there's no more.
He has so
chance.
Many opportunities where he could get revenge prior to when he does. Like, I mean. But, that's the kind of emphasis on it's the kabuki actor's revenge.
Exactly.
This is how a kabuki actor gets revenge. It's like, you know, it made me think of Salieri and Amadeus. Like, how does a composer get about killing someone? Like, how does he kill Mozart?
Exactly.
It has to be this. To me, that's part of the appeal, actually, is just, like, the strangeness.
And I
of
wish
the...
it would have been more, like you said, Judex or something where, take on some more masks or maybe...
Oh, I wish, like, if there was a little bit more, like...
now he's disguised as
the
shopkeeper.
Shadow or something like... They could have used that more. Like, I'm so excited when he does, like when he pretends to be a ghost. Like, that's such a fantastic scene. Like, I could have used like a dozen scenes like that, actually.
Yeah, and the Inogami family. So if you like Konishikawa in that way, you gotta watch the Inogami family, because that's his kind of detective mystery novel, which as I said before, is this really eccentric detective that has dandruff and he dresses like in old clothes and he's awful, but he goes through all these cases, and that's like a murder in a family, in an old family, and it has a lot of this disguise and which angle, kind of who done it with in another room, but the son is burnt by war, but is it really the son? And he has an amazing mask on that's like Friday the 13th or Jason or something. It's like the absolute joy, and that was his biggest box office success actually in 1976. And he does five more films also with Tatsuya Nakadai, and it's like I wish the box set was exist, because these are just so much joy, and it's almost like that's his preamble to these are not as beautiful, but they're beautiful, but of course they don't play with all this flair of a period piece. They're kind of they play earlier 19th century,
even the scenes where like Hasegawa's acting against himself, like I think, like, you know, that's fantastic. And I could have used more of it. Like, it's just, again, sort of the nature of, you know, if it was a film series like Zatoichi, where, you know, every couple of months you get a new one, like, it could have sustained itself for maybe, like, 3-4 films or something like that, or series. But, like, you know, it's so much fun seeing Hasegawa play off of himself and sort of acting against himself in those scenes where, like, it's sort of carefully done with the doubles and the cutting, so it's not
really well done, because
like you don't even think about it when you're watching. Like, it's not like, you know, a lot of films where they have like an actor playing two roles, it feels like really? Here's the scene where they're together, like
you're really aware of the shoulders and the way it's shot, especially in the 60s. I mean, this is early, and they do it seamlessly. He kind of appears out of this black void, and then the camera pans up, like that scene you were referring to on the roof, where all of a sudden he's on the roof. Obviously, it's just much easier with all that garb of a Onagata actor with all this hair, and it's easier in a shadow, in this dark shadow, to make it seem, but it's
the
still...
costume, the wigs, it sort of makes it a little bit easier,
But it's still like done extremely well, and just this time around, I mean, I paid attention to much more of the cutting and the editing of, especially in the fight scenes, which I just used to wash over me because they're so. And it really feels like, okay, I'm putting on a show and I'm playing with another genre in the genre. And of course, these are the moments when your heart soars and like, oh, I want to see more of all of it. It kind of leaves you wanting to see more, which is a good thing. It leaves you seeing more. But my favorite scene is also when Raizo Ishikawa appears. And he's kind of walking past him, and you see this great shot from above into the slum streets, which is a
great set piece. Looks like, again, like a cross section, almost like they just peeled off the top. Yeah, and you can see right through. Like, some of that, it kind of reminds me of like Brechtian theater a little bit, or the films that have been inspired by Brechtian theater, like Berlin Alexanderplatz, we sort of talked a little bit about, like, also has scenes where you just have like a bunch of people in a black box and a car, or like, you know, or even I mean, that shot that you described, like, that could have been something in, like, a, you know, Lars von Trier's Dogville, almost, you know, like, it has a little bit of that feel to it, where you're kind of aware of
the artifice.
Yeah,
it's almost a precursor, or it actually happening at the time. You're very right. It's kind of modern theater, where you just have kind of the bare bones walls of kind of like Peter Stein or these great German directors that come around at that time, Zadek, and the kind of high art theater that we see. And it's kind of this, what happens in England, the kitchen sink drama, where it's you signifying this poverty of these slums right away. This is the world he comes from, right? And you never really quite make this connection because he's so glamorous. But it would have been cool to see, not in flashbacks, because I have enough. I don't want to see the story fleshed out. That's perfect. I hate when they do that. So that's great. But it's kind of that world that to a Japanese audience is right away the kind of perverted monk that Katsu plays, and
archetypical characters,
or the female thief with the bumbling sidekick. These, we see them over and over again, so they don't need to dwell on it. We know right away, or all these things happen so quickly, but it's shot with such perfection that you almost would see like, I wish he would have done more period pieces in that way, because when he appears, Raizo, he's so glorious. You're like, oh my god, and he's kind of taking his position below Hasegawa, showing his respect, because he could be very testy. There are many stories of him. If he didn't like you, you were done, but because he's done so many
I've done 300 films, exactly. I don't have to take this from you.
Exactly, he does. And but also Raizo comes up and he's doing like 18 films a year. I mean, he's killing these Satan Sword movies. He's kind of, and they come up together. I mean, Shintaro Katsu and them, they even booked later as a pair, like Katsu Raizo. They're famous team, and they kind of have the same background. I mean, they're both born in 1931, and they both make the transition from kabuki theater to film, and takes Shintaro Katsu a lot longer to be a star. Like, he's always like the heavy and stuff until he finds Satoichi, of course, but he has a longer career because Raizo dies, unfortunately. But those scenes where they kind of it's that comment within the comment,
sort of give each other the nod, like they kind of like, I mean, again, it does feel a little bit like, not Satoichi the character necessarily, but when you're watching it, you do go, hey, it's Satoichi, kind of stumble into this film, and they kind of have this, like, ships passing in the night kind of feel, like, this character's going to go off and have some other adventure, you know, when you...
Exactly. You know who they all are. And so when Raizo makes a comment like, oh, I wish one day I become as famous as this thief, he's called the daytime kid. And the other one is called, they have all these flamboyant names, which are also set up in the beginning. It's kind of the age of thieves. And they have these cool names, which I tried to write down, but I forgot.
And that also feels like very like 1960s.
Batman.
A lot of the Japanese films that started to get a little bit more... stylistically, like, colorful and bold, you know, like Stray Cat Rock and stuff like that. Like, it just, some of the names kind of stand out in my mind as being a little bit like that when you hear them.
Influencing, leading back into film, and then vice versa, and the kind of youth culture, the Sun Tribe movies coming back in. But it's very much in this joy that I always enjoyed when it came to reading those stories, that there's this kind of band of ninjas aspect, that there are a lot of experts together who have all these different side stories. And in the West, that's often forgotten.
Another thing, too, that feels very 60s, even though this is early 60s, is there like these hints of sexuality that kind of come in, and there's nothing like overtly sexual really, but like it's sort of hinted at like just partly in the attraction between like Ohatsu and Yuki, or you know, like the Namichi, like her falling in love with him while he's dressed up just like a woman and speaking in this high-pitched voice, you know, there's sort of like overtones of, I guess, not necessarily lesbianism, but it's like, there's like a sort of a queer aspect to it. Like, this is still before Funeral Parade of Roses and stuff like that, but like it kind of feels, you know, inching in that direction compared to maybe some of the period films you would see.
Yeah, very just a much bit earlier. There's always been this kind of in tradition in the early 70th century, the kabuki theaters had like all women cast, so it wasn't
all... Yeah, it was like Shakespearean theater. Like, exactly. I think for a long time it was always...
So this gender-bending aspect was always there, and they were used a lot of... Why that got stopped, like, in there was a decree in 1629 when they were stopping this and saying, okay, from now on, all the female roles have to be played by men because the prostitution was so widespread under it. And they just sort of make that comment as well, and they were forced to shave the top head like a man, so that's why they have this purple cloth on top, which is the signifying of the Onagata, which you see all the way through, because they're trying to hide that they actually have to signify that they're men. So they have this kind of, you know, he always has that patch on top.
Yeah.
And so these gender bending roles, the joy of seeing that forbidden fruit in a weird way in the theater. And I've, you know, my father's a theater director, so I've seen many times this attraction that you could feel for somebody on stage, even if they're in beautiful or physically charming, just because of their performance and how attracted you are later. And when you see them, not necessarily sexually, just fascinated that this actor now is in, you know, we went to see him backstage, or we went to have dinner together, and you just marveled that he could just pull off this performance, this concentration. And that's sort of back then when there was no alternatives of TV and anything. I mean, it must have been just mind-blowing to be able to have access and then see these men transform. And I can only see, like, Akihiro Miwa, which is the most famous, it's like a man, stunning, beautiful man. He's in the Kinji Fukasaku Black Lizard thing. He's a famous drag queen and a singer, actor, composer, and he does the Mother Wolf voice in Princess Mononoke. He's one of the most beautiful humans you will ever see. Like, he's just stunning. And he's very famous for walking around in makeup in the 60s in a man's suit and kind of this before David Bowie doing his thing. And he was like a Ginza accepted nightclub singer. He wasn't like shunned or anything. I mean, this is very much in a Japanese culture that is not as taboo as they're trying to make it out to be. So this whole fascination of back and forth is something very foreign to us, but also very, once you've experienced like great theater, it's very understandable how this could easily happen. And a film is sort of, you know, it could be jarring because he's such a double chin old man, and and the close-ups are kind of flabby, but and you see her just mesmerized.
Well, when you watch on stage, Ed, like that, I mean, that's how Namichi falls in love with him, is while he's like on stage basically seeing him way at a distance, like we see on the widescreen. Like, that's kind of, you know, she falls in love with this performance really more than the person, maybe.
Yeah, it's a good but she becomes so lovesick, so infatuated, that she falls sick and she cannot return to the castle, and that's his inn, so to speak, because she asks for him and he's sent to the mansion, which is what he's trying to do. He's not trying to get invited to a restaurant. He wants to be in the house to kind of take her away from her father, so his whole empire falls. That's such a that first revenge impetus is so cool. That's kind of the story we get, and that's, but the last two are just then kind of puzzle thrown
in. The idea of going for revenge against him by hooking up with the daughter, like that's and I mean being, I
that's so cool. It's such a cool kind of the way they are together, like you said, you're referring to the sexuality, those tender moments, they kind of just embrace,
like, there's something that feels like just a little bit taboo in the way that, like, you know, when her hand reaches over and, or, you know, when they touch hands, or maybe it's the hand on the knee, like it just feels like, oh, like maybe something, you know, without necessarily being aware of what the exact cultural taboos are, it's like you sort of get a sense, just the way that it's shot, it's like, okay, there's something going on here that's like a little bit outside the norm.
She comments on it a lot because she's obviously a courtesan, so she cannot choose her lover. She's just forced to have sex with the shogun, like, whenever he wants. Mm-hmm. And so she's this young beauty, and everybody remarks on her beauty, but she doesn't get to fulfill any of her fantasies. I mean, it's probably just wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, kind of no love involved. And she kind of falls in love with the other, not this typical Japanese man. He is a male figure that is feminine. At the same time, he has all these skills, and sort of when it's tender, that she, you can tell she's kind of feverish with love, because all it's really cool the way they remark it in the text, because she's like, oh please, it's so amazing to see you outside of this, because he's seen her in the castle, and of course there's always this distance, and it must have been so excited to see each other with all this get up and gear, and then kind of private, and she says, oh excuse the mess, and you're looking around the room, you're like, what mess? I mean, it's perfect. But it's kind of, the blanket is a little, her hair's a little bit open, but of course when you're used to the castle, castle setting, there's no fault in any way. You'll be executed, you know, right away. So that whole playing with all these different settings must have been just so exciting back then, even to see each other close up and have your fantasies come true. And she's kind of feverish through this whole movie. And it's great to see, because by that time she's played these great heroines, and also in Ishikawa films, but she kind of also appears like a little a lower billing kind of. She's just fulfilling her damsel in distress role here, where she's a much bigger actress by that time already. So they all kind of pay homage, and it's a very cool way where they fulfill, like, they almost get to try out these roles that they would have on stage. Oh, let me fit into this. Let me slip this on.
Exactly. Like, it's sort of that fun of seeing a skilled actor kind of taking on, again, those sort of archetypical roles, and then just let me show you my abilities within this specific character. And like, I know also Kabuki theater, like, you do have these sort of archetypical characters, and it's like you are made up a certain way and you perform in a certain way. Like, it's sort of a language behind a particular character that you might inhabit. And it sort of makes me think a little bit of that, and just, yeah, you know, okay, I'm going to be playing the damsel in distress. You know, these are sort of parameters of my performance, and I'm going to do something special with that. Like, it made me think of that. And that tenderness of having this, you know, male hero in a revenge film that's not the typical sort of, you know, macho, you know, like, you think of, like, that revenge Charles Bronson type movie.
Such a weird, because he's not only frail and fat and kind of weird and an old actor, and it's not, he doesn't fulfill any stereotype.
Yeah. You know, and the fact that it is coming sort of more towards the end of his career, and he is, like you said, double-chinned and, like, not that, like, you know, he doesn't look that feminine, really. I mean, in the original, you see photographs that he did when he had that round face and he's full of makeup, but, like, you know, it's, like, very clearly a man when you're watching the film. Like, that's part of kind of what makes it interesting, too, and you sort of get the feeling that, like, as a character, this actor is kind of, you know, getting to the end of his career. Like, he retires at the very end of the film, and it's like, you know, as an actor, he's sort of getting to that point too, and it's like this, within the story, this revenge is kind of the last thing he has to do. There's a big difference in having an actor who's 30 years older playing that role.
And Kon Ishikawa, he right away, I mean, the close-ups are extreme. He doesn't hide it at all. He doesn't give us, like, oh, maybe there's this beautiful, like, there's just the opening shot. We go right into his face, and even the end shot kind of ends with him in a different makeup, and it comes to, like you said, these stylized forms. It's comical. He's making a joke because he's so close up to, you can interpret these movements as forms when these guys attack from behind. He kind of just does this pantomime move of the fighting with them, and it's so stylized, and when you're far away, he gives us the shot from the distance, you're like, wow, this looks amazing. And then he gives us the close-up, and you're like, oh, this is awful, badly done. And he kind of shows us this jittery theater world when it's really close up, and the bad, and not bad makeup, but the pores. You see all the pores. You see,
well, like, you're conscious of the fact that they're wearing makeup.
Yeah, the wig is so pronounced. He when the monk enters, you see the line drawn, like, with a Sharpie almost, like, because it's like, this is theater.
Exactly. Like, you sort of understand that what you're watching, it's theatrical. It's not like, oh, this actor didn't want to shave his head, we're going to stick a bald cap on kind of movies. Exactly. You know, like, there's plenty of those too. But I don't, like, the Blu-rays changed so many of these movies for me.
Yeah, I don't know.
Makeup-wise. But this one, it feels like very deliberate. Like, you know, right away, like, the opening theatrical performance when the old actor comes in, and, like, he's got, like, I'm not sure what it's made of. It almost looks like, like, more solid than just, like, a regular bald cap, but it's, like, really obvious that, you know, he's made up, and, like, you really notice a lot of this makeup. It draws your attention to it, like you said.
Yeah, it's great. His face is amazing. I mean, he looks straight from a Kuniyoshi wood block cut, like, just the mouth and the intimate scenes in their rooms when they're, it's so cool, the paraphernalia of the actors. I could have spent 5 more hours in that again, world, but
he does. Well, when she's looking at those woodblock prints, and she's like, yeah, that pasty face botched, like, she's going on about him, like, she's just trash talking him while she's also kind of, like, glowing at these images. But
she tries to resist his charms, and she falls for him eventually, and in the end she takes, like, her character is such a stereotype, cool archetype, not stereotype, archetype in all these movies, the cool, the female bandit, and completely just beautiful. And the ending shot, like we said, when the voiceover comes and he's sort of, he's never been heard from again. He took his revenge and he's disappearing. He actually dissolves. It's so clever. I never noticed this.
Fading further into the distance. And like, sort of the rumors talking about it, like, it's not definite what the narrator says. It's like, maybe he joined a bunch of traveling performers, or maybe he became a monk. And like, somebody remembers him disappearing into the fields, but who was it, you know, which character, what, like, what a great mysterious sort of way to end the film on, that kind of lingers in your mind.
So cool. And so many of these Japanese films from the time of Fires on the Plain or The Human Condition end just with like death, but goodbye cut,
like a really like sudden, like exactly, you know, there's a bit of that like Wild West like riding off to the sunset, but it gives you like a different tone to it, you know, this fading away into the distance.
Yeah, I never noticed it fading, because it's slight. I always thought they would cut and jump cut to the, for him being distanced, because my the quality I watched was so shoddy. But sure, now the fade is very slight. It really comes within a wheat field that's moving. It's amazingly done, because it doesn't jump cut or anything. It sort of blends.
It's like one image blending into the other, and the fact that he's facing away from the camera just adds to
the Miles Davis
mystery of it. Yeah,
turn this back on the audience, beautiful, like this, and then he's in this sterile, completely Van Gogh final set piece of his suicide, a wheat field as well. It's with the blue sky. It's just such a cool, what Kurosawa does later in Dreams, it's kind of reminiscent of the Kinoshita set pieces there,
right?
Like, it's such a cool way, and you would see, that's okay, true. I want to see part two right away, and it doesn't happen.
I know that. I feel like that's maybe the biggest takeaway from this is like, it could have been more. Like, it could have. I want more. Give me more.
Exactly, which is a good way. It's a good rather than overpopping. And I think for him, it was very much like, nice, I solved it, let's move on. Because I've seen so many interviews with him or everything I could grab through the years or read every piece. I never heard anybody besides like on the Criterion thing where they dug up some things. But he doesn't mention this movie. I mean, it's very much like, move on to the next. Like, he much more, everybody, of course, speaks of Tokyo Olympiad after, which was his kind of big break, after which he took a giant break, because that was only two more movies and he was like, I'm done. And his wife retires, because they're so attacked, because the government kind of gives him, Kurosawa is supposed to do it, he gets off the project and then he takes over and he gives them something completely different that nobody wanted. The government wanted to come up like, winners, this is a propaganda film, Leni Riefen style, and
he's right,
gives him the losers. He cuts this complete modern documentary. It's groundbreaking in the way that every documentary is structured like this now. They give you all these asides, he leaves the camera on a little bit too much, he sees the loser, he focuses on the third play. I mean, if you look at any Werner Herzog documentary, it's very much in the style of that. And
that's true. I mean, not even just like within sports documentaries, like it's considered, you know, one of the most influential documentaries made. So it's, you know, but like I do understand why it was controversial at the time.
Completely, yeah. If you work for hire and you don't show them any of the winners, you're like, nah, I'm not focusing on it. But it's an art house, it's a complete art film, and I love that he has the balls to do it, because nobody can tell me he didn't know that, you know, he knew exactly what to do with these jobs that he gets. He's like, okay, let me try this in here. I'm using this to try my craft at this. And and lucky for him, he goes right back after it and does like Tale of Genji, and he comes back all the time. He's like, you can't kill him, because he works for TV. He's like, okay, I'll work for TV. I'll cut out. Even later, I mean, Shin Segumi, he cuts out like foam board figures and he tries to make a stop motion film in 2000, when you really don't need a stop motion film anymore. He's like, you know, he's constantly experimenting and trying, and that's so sympathetic. I love that about him.
Yeah, I mean, like, with reinvention comes a lot of risk, and I think like what you see in these films is somebody who's not afraid of taking risks, and you know, very often it pays off, and he kind of keeps finding ways to not repeat himself, which like I think that's very interesting. Like, I mean, another film of his I've seen, it's the Princess Kaguya, the original version, and it's like, you know, complete beautiful fairy tale and the soft lenses, and like it's also very stylized, but not in the same way that this is. Like, it's again just this huge departure, and he can, you know, it seems like somebody who could constantly jump into a project and find maybe, you know, his particular way of telling the story, and just not necessarily.
Yeah, after the remake of the Burmese Harp that he does, I heard a lot of Americans always talk about this movie. I never seen it. The Adventures of Milo and Otis, which is
where they kill all the I think a bunch of cats died making that, which is
he's a sort of the thing you hear about. He produced that, so isn't it weird? Like, I thought, is it animation? Oh,
okay. I remember somebody telling me. I knew it was like a Japanese production, but I didn't realize he had something to do with that.
Because I only ever heard Americans being nostalgic about the movie and like, oh, when I saw this as a kid, I've never seen it, but I kind of thought
I think it's like a two-part thing where like people are nostalgic about it because they grew up watching it, and then they find out that like, every take they had to throw like a new kitten down a waterfall. Like, it was sort of, they would like break the cat's paw or dog's paw to get like a certain reaction shot. Like, horrible, horrible stuff. Like, no SPCA involvement at all. Like, it was just a massacre, yeah. I guess.
I didn't know
pretty,
that about
pretty
that.
Horrific,
but I thought
yeah.
it was funny to see his name. I stumbled on it because I was like, what is this? Is it a kid's movie or something? And it's like, Konichikawa. Like, they must have had this wrong. Like, what is he doing in there? And it's like, yeah. I thought it was animation for sure because...
No, it's like a Homeward Bound kind of thing where they have...
Dog, Benji runs home or something. Yeah,
which, like... I guess there was like a whole period when like films like that were huge in Japan.
Yeah, I'm sure. Like melodrama is huge. How should we say? All the war movies have that aspect. It's like even every of his where he's such a modern filmmaker. But if you watch the two Burmese Harp and Fires on the Plain, they're all talking about Japan or the Japanese soldier or coming home or being abroad and being misunderstood and finally coming home, seeing Japan one more time and then to die. And it's very much in this machismo that it's not. In this militarism, in this feudal Japan, mm-hmm. that's not them. Because him and Wada were like poster children of social consciousness, post-war consciousness. But even there, there's always this acknowledgement of the monks staying behind to bury the dead, to bury the soldiers. And it's Japan. It's something, of course, I found when I was living there that they're feeling very misunderstood by the rest of the world, which is easy to understand because every idiot mistakes karate and kung fu and sushi served in a Peking restaurant. I mean, the ignorance is insane everywhere. But that's so fun to see that even in the most satirical, cool, modern things, that's there. That there's a kind of homesickness and a big love for that.
Thank you so much for coming on. And if folks want to find you online, where could they look?
Yeah, I don't know. It's like Tumblr is weird now. That used to be my website for a long time, but I kind of find myself less posting on that. They mm-hmm. kind of censoring stuff. It's I don't know. I kind of stopped
that.
So Twitter is the only thing really. So it's Studio T Stella on Twitter. But anybody who follows you sees my stuff. It's cool. It's all working together. And that's sort of. Not at all. All my work is on there, but more of the recent stuff. I'm sure I post any kind of news or collaborations with Midnight mm-hmm. Marauder that I do. They're all on there. So Twitter is really the best for the film discussion.
Oh, perfect. And if folks want to follow this show, it's flixwise.com at flixwise on Twitter. I'm at Movie Kessler on Twitter, where you can see me going on and on about all kinds of movies. Thank you for listening, listeners. And don't forget, even if you have a double chin, you can still be beautiful. Until next time, take care. Hanabanashii seikou o osamete Ichimura za o uchiage. Nishi e kudaru kiku no jō ikkou no naka ni yuki no jō no sugata wa nakatta. Ichidai no mei oyama to utawareta Nakamura yuki no jō no yukie o otta mono wa oi. レミ太郎も探した。お初も探した。しかし誰一人その姿を再び見たものはなかった。ある噂には出家をしたといい。ある噂には北国の旅芝居に紛れ込んだとも言うが、噂のままにいつか雪の女王のことも忘れ去られた。 ただ、野脇の吹きすさぶ荒野を去りゆく雪の女王の幻を、いつまでも胸に秘めて忘れ得なかったその人は、
闇太郎か菊之丞かあるいはお初か。